Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
I think you know how fond I am of your rabbis and your cantor, but I just want to take a moment because Rabbi Davidson has taken many opportunities to thank many of you and to thank his rabbinic colleague, but I think we should just take a moment and celebrate the leadership of Rabbi Davidson. So I feel very blessed that some of the neighbors of this congregation have joined to be with us today. I want to make sure I know who's heard what so far. So how many of you were at services last night and heard the nursing care worker story? Okay. So for the folks who are coming in just this afternoon, you're jumping on a train that's already out of the station. And welcome aboard, because are we having fun?
Yeah.
We are. But that said, if anything was clear from my story last night, the powerful effects of congregation-based community organizing cannot happen on an island. A synagogue cannot organize alone. A synagogue needs a church, needs a mosque, needs a parish, needs a neighborhood, needs a community to act powerfully and collectively to make real change. So this afternoon's topic is really to understand the powerful transformative effects of community organizing in an interfaith context, and to actually get a taste of those effects. So we're going to do a couple things. I'm going to frame it with a short version of the story of Massachusetts healthcare reform, just so people can understand what this looks like after many years of a process like you may be embarking on right here in Chappaqua. But then to start back from the beginning and just give people an actual experience of community organizing, we're going to do an exercise that we call a house meeting. And then after that, we'll sort of talk about the process and answer questions, and I may tell another story if there's time. Okay? So hopefully people will be able to dig in a little bit deeper today. If you were here last night, you heard the story. Now is an opportunity to sort of dig in a little deeper. So in a real brief way, community organizing, how many of you have heard the name Saul Alinsky? Okay, so Alinsky was the sort of first person who thought of the model of congregation-based community organizing. He found himself in neighborhoods like the South Side of Chicago, where there was incredible poverty and incredible racism and real sort of destruction and suffering among very powerless communities like the African American inner city in the old cities of the Northeast or the Midwest or in the Southwest, real poor Latino Catholic immigrant communities. And he asked himself the question, how could these folks find any source of power in their lives to be able to affect the change in their neighborhoods and their communities? Because these were the most vulnerable and the least powerful members of society. And he had this epiphany. He was Jewish, but he had an epiphany nonetheless. And Joel, I think Rabbi Davidson ordained you as a rabbi. It wasn't an insult, though. It was a compliment, I think. Mazel tov. Alinsky was a Jew. He never stepped foot in a synagogue, but he did have an epiphany, which is that the one place where poor African American folks on the South Side of Chicago could have power is through their churches. Because in a democracy, there's power in numbers, there's power in institutions, there's power when people get organized and move together, right? We could see that playing out on multiple levels, right? All kinds of interests in this country are played out by the organized people and organized money that they represent. AIPAC is organized people and organized money. The NRA is organized people and organized money. Well, Alinsky thought to himself, if the folks that go to these churches could not just fight each fight alone, but if they could fight for better schools, better neighborhoods, better hospitals, together as churches acting in concert with one another, they would bring the heft and the weight of their collective power as institutions. Well, when community organizing was born by the network that he developed called the Industrial Areas Foundation, it was a fairly radical organization. He wrote his first book, which was called, just went out of my head, Reveille for Radicals. Reveille for Radicals, where he was trying to make a wake-up call for people to get them to pay attention. And then his successor, Ed Chambers, wrote a book called Rules for Radicals. Well, a lot happened over the years, and community organizing became a lot more mainstream. And here's how that happened. If the poor in inner city churches began to discover that they had more power when they acted together as institutions, over the decades, there was a realization that if the poor black churches were just acting as poor black churches, then the amount of power they could build to affect change was quite limited. And their scope would always be limited. And it was when, in places like Chicago, the poor black churches began to reach across to the large Episcopalian cathedrals in the city, but across town, and ultimately into the suburban congregations that ring Chicago, because they had in common the collective values of faith community, then they could build lots of power to bring their values and their concerns into the public square. And so that's when community organizing moved from a bunch of small local churches fighting for things like better local schools in their neighborhood, better sidewalks in front of their churches, putting up a stop sign, right, which were some of the first kinds of things, to build much more interfaith, much more broad-based, much more cross-class, cross-racial power to get things like health reform in Massachusetts, or the first living wage ordinance, which was passed in the city of Boston, or the tens of thousands of units of affordable housing in the South Bronx and East New York, that could only have happened when the churches in East New York and in the South Bronx worked together with the churches down on Wall Street. And together they got favorable mortgages from the banking industry. And that's when organizing became much more mainstream and much more about building collective political will. Let me just insert one addenda to that, which is that for the Jewish community, though Alinsky was a Jew, it was only about 10 years ago that there were more than a handful of synagogues that were part of the congregation-based community organizing effort. Right? So in cities like Chicago, or in New York, or in Los Angeles, or in Dallas, there were organizations of 40 or 50 churches that would act together on things like better schools, affordable housing, etc. And sometimes there would be one synagogue that was a dues-paying member of these organizations, but often it was sort of like their mitzvah project, where they would pay their dues to the organization. As the joke went in Boston, because Trinity Church Boston was doing this thing, we ought to do it too with Temple Israel, right? If the Episcopalians were doing it, then the Jews ought to do it too. But it wasn't something that cut to the core of the Jewish experience until around 10 years ago. We're all at once across the country, in Boston, on the level of some of the folks at the national level, in Los Angeles, in Dallas, rabbis began to realize that their most effective effort, and synagogue leaders realized their most effective effort at real social change, really getting to the root causes of social injustices, were happening through community organizing. And they asked themselves, how could we move much more wholesale, much more into the center of community organizing efforts? And in the last 10 years, it went from a handful of synagogues to more than 100 synagogues across America that are not only dues-paying members to interfaith groups like South Bronx churches or East Brooklyn congregations, or in my neighborhood, the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization. They've become, in some cases, central to the life of the organization. So Greater Boston Interfaith Organization, which is where I'm from, it's the affiliate of the Industrial Areas Foundation, a sister organization to East Bronx churches and South Bronx churches and East New York congregations and Manhattan Together, which is the Manhattan version, has about 50 institutions of which there's a minion of synagogues. So 10 out of 50 institutions are Jewish institutions. And this work is becoming much more mainstream in the Jewish world. So that's all a prologue for me to briefly articulate where this all heads over time, okay? Greater Boston Interfaith Organization, formed in 1996, after more than 18 months of priests and ministers and civic leaders meeting as congregations, discerning whether or not they wanted to act as a collective. And in 1996, 4,000 people packed the Reggie Lewis Center, and they articulated a shared platform, and the cardinal was there, and the mayor was there, and the senior rabbi of Temple Israel Boston was there, and the head of Trinity Church Boston was there, and together they committed to act as a collective and begin working together. Over the few years that followed, there were some nice small victories, more textbooks in the Boston public schools, better banking products for low-income people. You heard the story last night, some of you, of the nursing care workers campaign. All of this culminated in 2006 with the passage of the historic legislation that basically made it the rule of law in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that every resident had to have access to affordable quality health insurance. And when that bill passed, it was signed by Mitt Romney, who was a Republican governor, and it was passed by a Democratic majority in the legislature, and it had the support of the insurance community, it had the support of organized labor, and the Chamber of Commerce. It had the healthcare providers and the healthcare workers all at the table. And the question one would ask is, how did that happen? How did the political will got built to bring together those disparate stakeholders that are so often special interests that stand in opposition? And the answer is the organized faith community. Tens of thousands of folks in churches, in synagogues, and in a mosque came together on a regular basis to tell their stories, and over time become the ground troops in the war to make the Commonwealth a Commonwealth of Common Health, a war that ultimately was won. And by the way, it was folks like you. There was a member of my congregation, still is a member, named Roger Gottlieb, who in a house meeting at Temple Israel, when people were asked to share stories about what kept them up at night, what was of real concern to them, said, "My daughter's turning 25. And everybody looked puzzled. "Well, why aren't you celebrating?" "Well, do you know what he was concerned about? Do you know why he wasn't sleeping?" Right? This is a college professor who teaches philosophy. And when she turned 25, she was going off the family health plan, which was a generous health plan for the university for which he teaches, because she didn't receive employer-based insurance. And he said the words for the first time in his synagogue, "I can't afford to buy her private insurance." And there was a beginning of a recognition that healthcare wasn't some problem for other people. It wasn't some abstract concept on Capitol Hill or in the State House, but that it was something that was real for our members. There was a doctor in our congregation named Andy McAfee, who when it came to his turn said, "I'm considering quitting the profession." He's the head of the emergency room at a prominent Boston hospital. And when asked why, he said, "I went into medicine as a vocation, and I went into the emergency room to save lives. And on a regular basis, people die in my arms from preventable, treatable illnesses who went for years without primary care and went untreated because they didn't have health insurance." Right? And so it was tens of thousands of conversations like this that led to an organized political strategy that brought about the political will to make the change that was made. All right? I'm now going to stop talking about organizing and invite you to start with where it all begins. Now you've gotten a picture of sort of where it heads. So if you've heard the nursing care worker story, or you've heard this the healthcare story, you know what the exciting thing is at the end, but now I want you to taste the excitement of the beginning. And that is simply the process of a congregation saying, let's not start with some political agenda. Let's not start from the top down with some issue. Let's start with our lives, our values, our concerns, our members, ourselves. Let's start to tell some stories. And today, the goal is not to pick some issue to act on. The goal today is simply to get an experience and reflect on that experience. So we're going to do this exercise, and then we're just going to talk about how it felt. Okay? And the exercise is we're going to experience a house meeting. We're going to go around the circle at your table, all those who wish. If someone really doesn't want to do this, you don't have to. But those who are willing, and tell a story. And the purpose of the story that we're asking you to tell is a story that will help the people at your table understand something that is really concerning to you, that keeps you up at night. But we're going to ask that people not issue a rant, right? In other words, don't give a 5-minute lecture about everything that's wrong with global warming. Tell a story about why you care about global warming, okay? For example, I grew up with a grandmother who had a strong Russian accent, and I grew up during the height of the Cold War, and I used to tease her a lot and say, "Grandma, you're Russian. You're really Russian." And she would say, "I'm not Russian, I'm Jewish." And I would say, no, Grandma, come on, you have a Russian accent." She would say, "I don't have a Russian accent, I have a Yiddish accent." And I would say, "Grandma, don't you speak Russian?" And she would say, no, I speak Jewish. And I kept pushing her. I think it was my way of teasing my grandma. And finally, maybe she was getting sick of my pushing her, and maybe she was, trying to teach me something, but one time she said, when I asked her, "Grandma, why aren't you Russian?" She said to me that when she was a little girl, her father, when she was growing up in Russia, dug a hole underneath the floorboards of the house so that they had a place to hide when the Cossacks would come through. And she remembered one time looking through the cracks and seeing the rabbi of her town dragged to his death by a horse. And that's why when she was 16 years old, she snuck onto a boat and got herself to America. She was teaching me what it means to be an American Jew and to value the freedom and the privileges that we have here. And so when I see things playing out on a national scale, whether it's the immigration debate or some of the economic injustices that I see, I think about my grandma who came here and enabled me to be a rabbi in America. Okay, so that's a kind of a story. It could be about something very immediate and close that you're dealing with right now. Could be some story from your family's history, whatever it is that's going to be a real story, okay? And I think, could the people who met with me this morning, who are going to sort of help facilitate, will you raise your hands? Okay, the good people who are raising their hands met earlier today to have a conversation to prepare, so and they're going to help facilitate the conversation and maybe even start with a story of their own, okay?
Okay.
All right, and we'll do this. Everybody should take, 3 minutes. If it's going more than 3 minutes, you're probably moving from story into rant. We want to make sure. Okay? All right, enjoy.
Okay. You have either the good fortune of having two
you're
of
not
us.
Gonna
I didn't listen to every conversation, but I did listen to this table, and it was worthy of taking a deep breath. So take a moment and just let that experience sort of settle for you. Just take a second and dwell on the space of what you heard. For some of you, what you heard yourself say, and what you heard others say. And then I just want to open it up for some reactions, and I want to start with people's feelings. How did that feel? What feelings are you feeling right now?
Frustration.
Okay, frustrated.
Yep. Although no, we can do better.
Frustration, we can do better. Yes.
Anxious.
Anxious. What other feelings?
Sad.
There's some sadness. Okay. What else?
A little overwhelmed by the magnitude and the multiplicity of the issues and choices out here.
It could be overwhelming. Global warming, healthcare, economy.
Anger.
Some anger.
We have so much plenty, around, especially around here, and the problems are so vast and actually solvable. It does get you angry. Seem to be the same place today as we were 5 or 10 or 15 years ago.
So I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. Is that all right?
Yeah.
What are you going to do with that anger?
I'm not going to beat my dog. Because my second dog would be jealous.
You don't have to answer the question, Al. And I just want to think a little bit of that. What do we do when we have that kind of anger? Yeah,
I'm encouraged because I was having hit so many people care. Sometimes I can go all by myself.
Encouraged. Mm-hmm. Right? For other people care about this stuff. What else?
I feel closer because I didn't know any of these people before I sat down at this table, and I just got to hear very personal stories and really felt the connection to everyone.
Right, so connected. What else? How else are people feeling?
Can I have another one?
Well, sure, man.
I'm hopeful because I've lived in this town since 1995, and I've never been invited to this kind of forum. So,
how about that? How about that, Rob?
A little scared to be vulnerable.
A scare, a little scared.
To be vulnerable.
Because it puts you in a position of being vulnerable, particularly when you're used to walking in the room and everybody saying, "Hi, Rabbi." But I have a story too. I have a life too. I have fears, concerns, right? Everybody's walking in that way. Shabbat Shalom, let's just keep it nice. Okay, good. What other feelings are you having? Do you want to share? Earlier this morning, somebody asked me, I think it was Nona, right? Did you ask about that this is political in nature, right? You deal with healthcare. That was politics at the state level, the attorney general, politics. And she asked me, what kind of language do you use to help people get past their immediate associations with politics? One of the things we talk about is it is political to talk about that. But for me, part of it is when a religious institution acts on its values, when a religious institution acts on its values, that means that when we say Shabbat Shalom, how are you? We mean it. When Rabbi Davidson last night invited people to share the things that they were struggling with, people who were ill, and then asked people to stand up if they were celebrating, he meant it. So part of this work is a congregation that acts on its values in the public square, fighting for things like healthcare, but inside the congregation as well, where we become a place where people share their stories and their concerns. And sometimes it makes us frustrated or sad for things that are wrong or angry, but hopefully at the same time connected and energized and hopeful because we see things changing. The basic premise of community organizing is it doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. In order to get health reform in Massachusetts, Roger Gottlieb and Andy McAfee had to sit at a table like this and go public with their private personal pain. Andy was struggling with being a doctor in the emergency room. Roger was struggling with his daughter turning 25. That was personal, and he had to take it public in order to begin the process to recognize that things change. Alinsky, by the way, liked anger. And he talked about the difference between cold anger and hot anger. Hot anger is when you beat your dog. Right? Rage. And his thought was if you could get out of people the things that really... I made it nice. What keeps you up at night? He'd say, well, what are you angry about? What really, really? Angry enough, because anger, when it's cold anger, drives us. The nice way to put this is passion. Where's Maxine? Maxine earlier today talked about trying to uncover passion, people's passion, right? That's a much more comfortable way of thinking about this. And we need to know what people's passions are because if they're not passionate, they're not going to show up. We need to know what you're really angry about because if you're not really feeling it, you're not going to actually show up. And all of the work of community organizing is around actually coming together and showing up because the Attorney General, well, forgive me for the people who weren't there last night. For people that were there last night, when the Attorney General changed his mind, why did he change his mind? What happened? What's the teaching of the story?
His mother's story.
It became personal.
Okay, his mother's story, right? He talked about his own mother who was an immigrant. It became very personal. He was moved by the stories.
Did check bounce from his Packers?
He did what? Well, in a way it did bounce, okay? Hold on. So absolutely there's the piece that made it really human to him. He personalized. Right? Our community personalized. The story was real for him. It connected with him. That is only half the story. He could have said, I feel your pain. Right. My mother was in your situation. But it's really complicated. The check didn't bounce. The check went through. So what happened? From his campaign, Stan asked if the check bounced or was campaign contributors.
He lost the election.
Not yet. He was still a candidate at this time. What could explain why he would go against the source of campaign contributions?
Saw the number of people.
Political power, mm-hmm. Pure and simple. Whenever I tell the story, people say, oh yeah, he was moved by the stories, right? I believe he walked in the room and changed his mind when he saw who was there. Mm-hmm. Temple Israel of Boston, Trinity Church Boston, the Catholic Archdiocese, all in an array, representing 25% of the voting districts of the whole Commonwealth. He made a very quick and very smart political calculation. Mm-hmm. And he could do it in a way that was moving mm-hmm. and powerful and connective, right? It's a both and. If we sit here, you know, just telling our religious narratives and then telling our personal stories, it will be nice. But nothing will change. In organizing, we think about the transformation of the world as it is, which is broken, into the world as we know it should be. The problem is if we pretend we live in the world as it should be, where all you have to do is tell an elected leader a good story and they'll do the right thing, then nothing's going to happen. We have to operate as if we're in the world as it is, which is a world in which the nursing care industry is making donations to our Attorney General, who ultimately, by the way, did lose the election.
Okay. For the right reasons.
He lost for good reasons, actually. The person that he lost to in the Democratic primary was a guy named Deval Patrick, who spent a lot of time in church basements and synagogue basements all across the Commonwealth listening. Remember when Hillary Clinton, your neighbor, ran for Senate? Way back in the day, do you remember what she did? She ran a listening campaign.
She went to yeah.
Okay, she, you know who she wrote her doctoral, her undergraduate thesis on? Saul Alinsky.
Oh, there you go.
Okay, people who are smart public people understand the power of organizing. You get into people's homes, you get into their pews, you get into their parishes, you get into their living rooms, and you listen and figure out what the connections and commonalities are, what people are interested in fighting for, okay? So now I want to shift a little bit in the... any other reactions or comments about the experience of that? Okay, I want to do... In the last little bit that we have, I'm going to go off mic. Can you still hear me okay? Okay, good. No?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes.
I didn't get an answer, so... I'm going to try and do a story now to teach off of. So it's not just about, oh, isn't that a beautiful story, but rather, is it a parable that has something to teach us, which is a story I picked precisely for this congregation because I hope it will feel very much close to who you are, okay? I told the story of the Nursing Care Workers in Healthcare, which was Temple Israel of Boston, a large urban congregation that's been doing this work since 1996. So 10 years later, got to healthcare. I want to tell now a story about a suburban congregation in Newton, Massachusetts called Temple Shalom of Newton. It's about an 800 or 900 family congregation in the suburbs, Newton, Massachusetts. How many of you know Newton? Sort of like Scarsdale, right? I mean, is that a good analogy? It's not that far into the urban center that it's from, but it's definitely the leafy suburbs, okay? And Temple Shalom of Newton was not at the founding of the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization. When it began, it was really a city-centered organization, and over time began to broaden its reach, broaden its power by beginning to organize the suburban congregations, which is why Temple Shalom gets in the picture and why Bethel Congregation of Northern Westchester gets in the picture. This work has been going on in Manhattan, the Bronx, Brooklyn, and Queens for years. But now there's a thought, well, what if we actually looked metro? There's a Long Island organization. What would it look like if we actually got into Westchester? What could we do in New York State if we really had broader reach? Okay, so Temple Shalom of Newton, which is not yet part of GBIO. GBIO is something, you know, like down in Manhattan or whatever, right? Temple Shalom goes through an exercise like this about 2 years ago and says, we want to start organizing, right? So they begin their listening process. They begin their one-on-ones and their house meetings, and they're working with one of the organizers from GBIO who's trying to help build something in the suburbs, much like you may ratify a decision to start working with an organizer from the Industrial Areas Foundation who would come up from New York to begin working with you. And they go through their house meeting one-on-one process where they do their internal listening campaign to begin to surface stories about what is on people's minds. And they hear, so in this small congregation, 800, 900, how many families here?
650.
Very comparable congregation, okay? Here's Temple Shalom, a relatively small institution in a big universe of the greater Boston area, and they surface four baskets of stories in their house meetings and individual conversations. One is around the environment. There's just this incredible, widespread feeling that we're cooking ourselves into a stew with global warming and toxic emissions. And the stories took on all kinds of forms about how people were articulating with this, but it was a real shared frustration about the environment. Okay? There was also a whole set of people who were struggling with debt. There were people whose mortgage, remember this is Newton, right? So it's like big houses on big interest-only mortgages, five-year arms, they were all recalculating. People who had maxed out home equity lines to fund kids' college educations. People who had to take on extra loans to fund higher education. And all of a sudden when the banking thing collapsed, the credit card industry starts jacking up rates for no reason. Somebody misses one payment, they go from 3% or no percent interest on a credit card to 28%, and they are carrying a $20,000 balance and are being crushed by this kind of debt. So there's a widespread story of debt happening all over the place, and this is in the affluent suburb. Mm-hmm. That doesn't look so different than this one. It's interesting what you learn when you actually get people talking, okay? Another set of issues, they made a strategic decision to get into the teen population and did some organizing with teens. They actually engaged a teen organizer to do a series of conversations with a teen leadership team that started to surface stories from teens. And teens were telling stories like kids that were using drugs. There were kids who, there were three suicides in the high school in 1 year. There were kids who were struggling with the workload. There were girls who were cutting themselves, right? So this sort of basket of stories about teen stress and the incredible pressure the kids were under. And then the fourth story was around a cut to the budget that was going to eliminate the METGO program. People who know Boston area know METGO. Remember busing? Okay, busing is the big story. If you live in Boston for any time, busing is our big story, right? Mm-hmm. When kids got, right, in the civil rights era, bused to other, because it's, talk about a racially polarized city. New York is a beautiful, integrated city compared to Boston historically. So METGO was the program that brought inner-city African-American kids to the suburbs like Newton and Wellesley, and they were going to cut the METGO program in Newton, which would have meant that this otherwise not particularly diverse suburb was going to become even less diverse, and a lot of people were very concerned about that. So now people in the congregation are beginning to feel a little bit like Stanfelt, overwhelmed. How on earth are we, Temple Shalom, one little Jewish synagogue, in one little suburb, in one little city, in one little state, gonna be able to do something about environmental, about global warming, around the incredible debt burdens that we're carrying, around the end of this this process of cutting the state budget for education, and around the stress of our teens. So how do you get a little bit less overwhelmed? inside of a situation like this. What would you do? Okay, so part of the answer is, we're not going to solve the world's problems tomorrow. But we can pick one thing that we can make an issue and then make actionable. And part of the discipline of community organizing is how you move from a world of problems that are overwhelming into a world of issues that you can take action on and win. Right? Remember, health reform in Massachusetts happened 10 years into the life of the organization, with lots of smaller issues and actions along the way, building more relationships, building more power, so that they had the clout to do health reform. So the first thing is to begin to drill down through conversations and research on how we can make these into narrow issues where we can win on. So that's one. What's another way that you feel less overwhelmed by how small you are and how big this is?
Find others who are aligned with your...
And where are you going to find those others?
Community.
Okay. First Church Newton. St. John's Episcopal. The Muslim Society of Boston, right? The congregation begins to reach out to the neighbors who they had been doing. There's a clergy association. Do you guys have a clergy association? Okay, there's a clergy association. There is the Interfaith Council. There's lots of meetings. There's lots of talk. There's some good projects, and that's it. But now, leveraging those relationships, the leaders from Temple Shalom start getting into other congregations and dreaming with them. What if we work together? What if we imagined a world where we could act as a collective? Are you hearing stories like these? And so the churches got into their membership and started surfacing similar kinds of stories and realizing that in all of these areas, there was a shared agenda, there were shared concerns, and they formed something called Newton Congregations. And Newton Congregations now is 25 institutions. So they go from 800 families to like 20,000 families. And those 20,000 families represent a lot of power in the city of Newton, which is now on the story. I actually live in Newton, so I'm very proud of this, okay, because I was always running to Boston to organize. But I would come back to my leafy suburb at night, and I'd be like, well, you know, we do this in the city. They don't do that out here in the suburbs. Well, guess what? We do this in the suburbs, okay? The Temple Shalom is very near where I live, okay, and this is alive right now. There was just an assembly last week, the culmination of a lot of this organizing, because Newton is about to elect a new mayor. And there are two candidates for the mayor. So the rabbi called the two candidates' campaigns and said, Newton Congregations, which is 25 institutions representing 20,000 residents of Newton, will be gathering together, represented by 500 actual human beings at Temple Beth Avodah, which is a sister congregation in a neighborhood of Newton. And we're going to roll out our platform, and we're going to lay out our issue agenda, and we're going to ask you, will you commit to our issues if you're elected? So the two candidates for Newton mayor, of course, accept happily the invitation. And one at a time, leaders of this effort get up to tell stories. The team leader gets up and tells a story about what it's like to go to school and have kids who are stressed out and overextended all the time, to have friends that they know are using drugs and drinking too much because they're trying to, and there's no support services for them. There's no system in the school. There's no way that they can deal with this. There's no communication between all of the various demands on them. There's teachers who are assigning homework and the AP programs and then the extracurricular activities and the religious institutions. So they're getting bombarded from all sides, and they need some relief, right? And the folks from the environmental world get up and they lay out their platform. Pause the tape. In the same process, they're now drilling down how to make these issues actionable, right? So they do some research. They do a meeting with the head of Public Works of Newton, a team of leaders, to start, you know, sort of uncovering, you know, what they can do. And they find out something that shocks them. Though the city of Newton recycles, right? If you drive through, you'll see the blue cans and the green cans. The blue cans are for garbage and the green cans. Religious institutions, the blue can and the green can, goes into the same dumpster because it was too expensive to send the stuff to recycling. So the faith leaders say to the head of public works, well, we demand that you change that. We are not going to have our institutions feed global warming. We demand that you recycle. And he said, well, there's a contract. So the leader said, okay, change the contract. Mm-hmm. All right, so that's the backdrop of the drama that's happening with the mayors. They do some research with the city treasurer. And with the city treasurer, they ask the question, we realize that Newton is the single biggest consumer of banking products to the banks that are based in Newton. What if we drafted a set of principles, the way that good banks operate, like not raising your interest rate from 0% to 28% because you were late by a day for a payment? Right? What if we came up with a set of protocols to help people whose mortgages recalculate and they're struggling? What if we moved city money into the banks that were willing to work with us to protect consumers who live in this community? Treasurer got nervous, right? The METCO program, right? City and state dollars to fund the METCO program, right? So these are now issuable, actionable issues. Picking up the recycling from religious institutions, working with banks, putting city money into banks that are good banks that are helping consumers, refunding the METCO program, lining up a task force to work with the extracurricular activities, the public education, the superintendent of schools, the parent-teacher organization, with significant student representation to begin to coordinate so that students can have their concerns addressed about their overstress, or they're having too much time, and spend money on such a commission so that it actually would be able to function and do work. So each of the candidates hears these compelling stories, has leaders who have practiced and rehearsed. There's 500 people in the room. I was at this action as a citizen and a representative, a person who lives in Newton. And one at a time, each of the mayoral candidates gets up, and this is truly nonpartisan work. Both candidates get up and committed to the entire agenda. And said within, and that one was asked, will you meet with us within 60 days of your election to hold you accountable to the progress you're making on these four items? And Newton congregations began to understand themselves as a collective to be able to act powerfully on interests, even though for the short term they're very local. They're relatively small if you think about health reform on a statewide level. But here's where, and I'll stop with this, the story gets a little bit interesting. There was a time when Newton congregations just wasn't sure whether it wanted to be part of GBIO. Right? That was some city thing, and they were radical, and they did, right? But we're in the suburb, right? As they went through this process, they began to realize the power of the collective and how they could actually have an impact on their world by organizing together. Right now, Massachusetts is in the process of electing the first person to sit in Senator Kennedy's seat in 46 years. That has enormous implications. And GBIO is a very powerful statewide organization. And so the question that was posed, the action of the evening, was to ask, now Newton congregations, now that you've discovered the power of your collective in a very small local arena, will you stand with the rest of the churches and the synagogues and the mosques of Massachusetts, from Roxbury and Dorchester and Mattapan to Brookline and Cambridge and Lexington? Will you stand together as we hold our Senate candidates accountable on a broader agenda around health reform and environmental protection and banking regulations? Right? And they're now going to move more deeply into the center of the statewide organization. Okay. Let me pause. Let me ask you to react, ask questions for clarification. We have about 10 minutes, so we'll sort of give you an opportunity to engage a little bit.
How do you deal with situations where the groups feel that their opinions are not known? In other words, people come and people from one institution feel a certain way about it, an issue, and the people from another congregation feel no. I mean, how do you deal with that? Because there have to be those situations.
It's a great question, and it happens all the time. Organizing is about standing for the whole. It's about what we can act on together. So there are a couple things that can happen. There can be some things that surface that are very local. I told a story this morning about a congregation, very affluent congregation in the Bay Area, Marin County, that's on the very affluent side of town, and they don't have a building yet. And they're building a relationship with the churches on the Latino poor side of town. And largely they're doing it because they like this community organizing thing, they like all the conversations, but they really want to go help the poor Latino community, okay? In the middle of all of this, it comes out that the zoning board voted no to allow the synagogue to build a building. And it was clearly because the group of people who were in power did not want the Jewish community to grow. And when the Latino Catholics heard this, they filled up buses to go attend the zoning board meeting to put pressure on the zoning board, which it turned over its decision because of the power of numbers. So sometimes you stand together on other people's issues just because you're in a relationship. And that only would have happened because of 2 years of relationship building between the Catholic community and the Jewish community. Sometimes the issues are divisive. For example, in a lot of the synagogues and in some of the church communities of Massachusetts, gay rights and gay marriage was a huge priority.
Right.
And in some of the Catholic parishes and in some of the African-American churches, it was absolutely anathema. So in a community organizing mode, How might you think about handling a situation like that? What might you do?
Maybe you have to do the right thing in a political sense.
I don't know what that means, so what would you do? I don't know what that means.
I guess it's the same way when I'm in the conversation when they asked Truman about it wouldn't be in our favor because of the oil, et cetera. And he said, sometimes you have to do the right thing, not the political thing.
But so what does that mean? So give me a, what do you do? So you've got a bunch of UCC churches, a bunch of Jewish synagogues, a bunch of Episcopalians all fighting for gay marriage. You've got a bunch of black churches and a bunch of Catholic parishes fighting against gay marriage. So be practical.
You have to personalize the issue.
And how would you do that?
Stories.
Yes.
And bring people in who are affected by the negative way this culture is currently structured.
Okay, so
let them talk about their hurt and pain.
We literally found ourselves at events on the opposite side of, this wasn't happening obviously through the interfaith organization, but in public moments we found ourselves on the opposite side of the table. And so because of the deep relationships that were formed in this interfaith work, we committed not only to meet and talk about it, but to do house meetings so that folks could tell their stories and understand how this issue was actually impacting on their lives. And as a result of that process, the African American ministers and the Roman Catholic priests who were members of GBIO stopped speaking to the press about that issue. They weren't going to change their position, and this is not about convincing people, but they recognized that there were real human beings on the other side of the equation whose lives were affected, and so it changed their understanding of how they would be public people about it. So the answer is no, we're going to always agree on everything, but we always commit to being in relationship and exchanging the real story so we understand how these things, and it happens around Israel. It happens around all kinds of issues. Okay. What else?
I had a couple of questions, actually. The first one is related to the issue of the teen stress at Newton. What was it ever addressed, and was there a coalition?
This is Wednesday night of last week.
Oh, fabulous. So, okay, there you go.
You know, I mean, are we going to solve teen stress?
It's hot off the press.
No, remember, we're not going to solve global warming either. And we're not going to solve teen stress.
If there was a coalition, you're not going to solve it. In Briarcliff, there's a parent coalition right now. This is one of the issues about bringing to the table about how to address, you know, when you have different factions of people. There's a group who's in incredible denial, and then there's a group that wants to address it head on, that there's a real drug, there's a real substance abuse problem in its community. So anyway, I was just curious if that went anywhere.
My advice to you is don't get stuck in the weeds, because it's going to look different here.
Yeah.
I think I was talking to the folks at dinner last night about the way in which the migrant worker population has been dealt with in this community and in another community next door. There, you can deal with these things well or not well. My advice to you is when you get in this work here, if this is the kind of thing that you don't even know what's going to surface for you. Maybe this is what's going to surface for you.
Sure.
You'll figure out the way this community is going to attack that.
And actually my second question, and I think, you know, looking at that one as both a clinical social worker and a parent, you know, you can see all these different sides of, you know, all these issues, but this in-the-house questioning, the conversation, are we going to talk about that, how it works as to these interviews, these meetings?
No.
What it looks like?
No. So what you're going to do as a congregation is you're going to figure out if this is what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
If it's what you want to do, then you go through lots of training. The people who are the house meeting facilitators, the people on the leadership team go through a whole training regimen to get ready. It would be like a capital campaign, right? So were you involved in the capital campaign here? Okay.
I know someone intimately who has.
Okay. Right, so, as I said this morning, imagine committing to a capital campaign where you've never seen a building get built and you've never raised money.
Right.
You'd be like, how does this work? What does it even look like? Right, so this is just for you all. The whole purpose of this weekend is to paint a picture about the palace that you can build and the relational campaign you might run to get there. Then you decide, do we want to do this? And do we want to do it over at St. John's? Or no, you're at St. Mary's.
Church of St. Mary the Virgin.
Church of St. Mary the Virgin. And do you want to do it over at St. John's St. Mary?
Yeah.
And do you want to do it over, right? And do you want to be, I think, how many institutions are discussing this right now? 50?
Yeah.
There's 50 congregations across Westchester that are currently thinking, do we want to do this? You'll discern that. Once you discern that, you'll take next steps. All right, so here's what I'm going to do. Let me ask everybody who has a question. I'm not going to answer. Let's ask the questions. Let's surface them, and I'll see if I can bring it to closure. So Rob, and then Phil. And you got the last one.
Can read my name for that interest.
I am
good. All right, the question is fast. In each of the organizations that is in this consortium getting together, there are only a certain amount of folks who are part of these organizations. So, and they have obviously the same ideas, the same views, or maybe not, and they kind of come to people. But what happens to the other 80% out in the community who are not part of the organization? I'm assuming there must be some sort of outreach to find out if the opinions of the order of the community are supported by what conclusions are coming with a group like this.
We have an expression. Well, let me get Phil, and then I have a thought about that. Go ahead, Phil.
Just briefly, what is the structure of Newton Congregations? Is there a leader? Is there a committee?
There's a community organizer and there's a leadership team. And the leadership team, which is represented from each of the congregations, that is Newton Congregations, and it's on them to be in constant contact with the congregation. So not just the board. I mean, like, that's why you do all those house meetings, so you're in touch with the membership, and they come together and make collective decisions. And the organizer, it's called organizer on purpose, not executive director, right? They don't run it. The organizer trains and facilitates so that the leaders can run the organization. So the answer is no. We have this expression, organizer. We organize who's there. I'm working with you because you showed up. If a church doesn't want it, they're not at the table. Over time, more churches get in it because they sort of see what's happening, and they say, well, we have concerns. Well, come show up. Any church that wants to join, any mosque, if they're willing to roll up their sleeves and get in it. All right, I think, should we give Manny the last word?
This is a process and organizational thing. One of the things you hear a lot in this community is the lack of time and the overcommitted. In light of that environment, getting people to commit and get involved into something other, I mean, by the way, a capital campaign is easy in comparison because at least you see light at the end of the tunnel. It's a building.
It's much easier. Oh,
yeah.
Much, a capital campaign is much easier.
Much easier.
As hard as it is.
Because it's hard. I mean, you get something at the end. In comparison to this, this is kind of...
Someone help Manny, okay? So yeah, people are so busy. In a community organizing mode, how do you think that through? People are too busy. How do you get them to add another thing? Elise?
No, we were saying before, if it's something personal. So if they have a teenager or and friends who have issues, even if they have no time, they're going to make time.
The reason why 550 people on a night in Newton, Massachusetts, people are busy, they work really hard, their kids have homework, there's da-da-da-da-da. Why do they pack that synagogue representing 25 churches? Because the stuff really, really matters to them. That's why you go through all this listening, because then you discern what really, really matters. And by the way, not everyone's at the table. There are going to be some people who say, oh, this is fine, it's not for me. That's okay.
I didn't want to minimize the capital campaign because I know there's something going on here. but it, my impression, especially in more affluent communities, is it's a lot easier to write a check than give a minute of her time.
Mistake we make too often, and with this I'll close, because as a rabbi in a synagogue, I did this for years. I'd give a sermon and say, this is really important. Come to this event because I think it's important. And people would be coming to me at the owning and say, great sermon, rabbi. And I'd say, oh, great, well, will you be there? No, I'm too busy. But the mistake I was making was, I wasn't listening. I was talking. When you listen to people, you hear what they really want and what they value. And if you listen for the commonalities, you know what's important enough to people that they'll show up. And consistently, we see there are things that people show up to. You all showed up this afternoon. There's something about this place, this community, that matters to you. Okay, tomorrow morning, it will be packed in this building, won't it? It matters to the folks who are bringing their kids in the morning on a Sunday, or the adult learners who come, or whoever's showing up. Friday night, it mattered to people. The question is, can we tap into what really matters to people and leverage that into the power for redemption of our community? Okay, Shabbat Shalom.